43rd mayor of Miami. He served two terms since 2017, and his tenure is going to end in September because he's term limited. Although I hear these days that's flexible. Please welcome Francis Suarez.
We were ranked the happiest city in America, the healthiest city in America. The formula for success is simple. Keep taxes low, keep people safe, lean into innovation.
How are things going in Miami? Obviously, you know, we talked to you a couple of years ago when we had our first all-in summit here.
Yep.
And you had a no-nonsense approach that you thought was going to work with the homeless challenges that we're seeing. I think, candidly, we discussed a large portion of the homeless problem in these major cities is an addiction problem. And, you know, giving a junkie a home doesn't exactly get them off the street. It just doesn't work. And you were one of the first people to say that plainly. How are you dealing with it? Has it gotten worse? Is it an intractable problem? Yeah, take us through it.
So, in homeless specifically, we are at an 11-year low. We did our census. We do two census a year. We do one in January, one in the summer. And our January census had us at an 11-year low at 546 homeless, unsheltered homeless in the entire city of Miami. We have a couple thousand sheltered. And I actually raise money on an annual basis as a mayor's ball. I did my mayor's ball last year, and this year I'll be doing it on May 31st to end homeless. We want to be the first major American city to have zero homeless, and we think we can get there. We call it functional zero. We do. And frankly, the strategy is not that complicated. You know, obviously, there's a macroeconomic strategy. We have the lowest unemployment in America. We have the highest median wage growth in America. I lower taxes to the lowest level in history. And we've seen 140% growth in 9 years. So the economy is robust. We were ranked the happiest city in America, the healthiest city in America. Frankly, if you're happy, you're healthy, and you're working, you're probably not homeless. And then, of course, we've done innovative things in the homeless space. We've worked with charitable organizations that help people reunify families if they live in other parts of the country. And also we rent homes so that we can get around the building process and give all the same wraparound services, but we sort of hack through that process.
Those 500 individuals who are categorized as homeless, how many of them are suffering from mental illness and or self-medicating / addicted to drugs?
A very high percentage. I would say 80% plus.
Right? Right.
And that's sort of anecdotal, but I've been out to the streets. I'll be out there before my homeless ball now on May 31st. I'm actually gonna spend a night out on the street. And when you talk to them, when you engage in them, a vast majority of them are, unfortunately.
Okay, so let me double click on that. This problem wasn't as acute before the super drugs, meth, like the serious
opioids,
meth.
The
really serious ones they're making now.
Fentanyl.
And fentanyl, right? This combination seems to be, you know, we had people addicted to heroin like Miles Davis and like Philip Seymour Hoffman, who produced incredible art and were addicts for 30 years and they went in and out of it. But this drug is pernicious, different, deadly, super addicting. How much of the problem are those two drugs specifically, if you double clicked on it?
A big part of the problem, heroin or opioids.
He's asking for a friend, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm asking if you have a hookup.
It's just
clearly.
No, but I'm being deadly serious because we had these homeless individuals in New York, you know, back in the day in the 70s, 80s. They were kind of like hobos and vagabonds, not seriously addicted, you know, suffering where they're folding over and curled up in a ball from fentanyl.
Well, to your point, I mean, meth and the opioids are incredibly addictive and they're very hard to beat. Right? I mean, even people who are wealthy and get addicted to these drugs have a very hard time. The recidivism rate is very high. And so, you know, you just had Antonio on here a minute ago, and he was talking about, you know, immigration and the border. And one of the big problems with the border is the tens of thousands of people that die annually because of fentanyl that gets imported through China and through our border. And so there's a tie-in, right, between federal policy and local policy. But for us, in 1980, during the cocaine era, right, different drug, we had 220 homicides. So you had drugs hurting people, but you had the business of drugs very much hurting people, right?
Yeah.
So we started recording homicides in 1946 in Miami. 1946, we had 32 homicides. From 1946 to today, the lowest number we ever had was 24. Last year, we had 27.
Wow.
Okay, we had 220 in 1980. This year we're trending below the 24. So this may be the safest year in the recorded history of Miami.
Can you connect those dots though? Like, I think when people think about social policy, everybody confuses the correlation and causation.
Yeah.
But you've been in the seat now for a long time.
Yeah.
So you've seen what hasn't worked, what has worked, what maybe has been correlated. But if you had to sort of like lay out the roadmap for other cities, but frankly for other states, the rest of the country, what's the roadmap, the Francis Suarez roadmap?
The formula for success is simple. Keep taxes low, keep people safe, lean into innovation, right?
That's for the city. Can we just double click into those?
Yeah, of course.
So
I can double click on each one of them.
Let's take the other side of these things just to help the conversation.
Right.
Because I believe in them, but let's try to steel man the other side.
Sure.
Keep taxes low. What people say, if you look at California and if you look at New York, what they would say is, we have a duty to invest in the social services and the infrastructure to support everybody that isn't necessarily as well off or didn't get the right side of luck. And we need to raise taxes in order to generate the revenues to fund that.
My counter argument would be government is not a good purveyor of those services. It's not an efficient purveyor of those services. So just to double click, right? I lowered taxes to the lowest level in history, and I took the city in 2009 as a councilman out of bankruptcy. So I got it in bankruptcy. We decided, this is sort of the Doge before Doge. We decided not to raise taxes. We cut costs. We didn't let anyone go, but we had tiered salary cuts, pension reform, and we balanced our budget. And we had 10 years of prosperity, and that prosperity led to a tripling of the size of our government. So we went from a $500 million government to $1.5 billion government while lowering taxes. So we grew 200%, right? So the resources that we had to dedicate to these actually went up, even though taxes went down. And then, when you have a place where there's prosperity and where people are investing and where people are employed, they're obviously not, there's not as many social problems. So they're not out there killing people. They're not out there hurting people. So the 1980s, we had, we were one of the murder capitals of America. And we're now one of the safest big cities in America. And then I think, the how can I help moment that you guys are all familiar with was this juxtaposition with what American cities were doing, right? Famously, New York competes for and wins the Amazon HQ2 prize.
Right.
And then rejects it.
Rejects it, yeah.
And also famously in California, you had a legislator that said, F Elon Musk.
Yeah, Elena Gonzalez.
Exactly, and he replied, message received, and he left.
And then she went to run a union, right?
Yeah,
she ended up?
Yeah, I think she went to work for a union.
She's the CEO of one of the big unions now.
But the issue is, what I tell people is, look, it's bad enough to kick out a $1 trillion company from your city, or the richest person arguably in the world from your city. But think about the signal. The signal to me is much, much greater, right? The signal is, if you want to bring another headquarters, or if you want to be another company, we just got FC Barcelona. 2 days ago, we announced that FC Barcelona moved their headquarters from New York to Miami, right? Every single day, we announced, $900 million of loans in two projects in the last 2 days in two buildings, our stadium, our Inter Miami stadium. Yeah. We have the FIFA World Cup headquarters for 2026 in the world, right? So, I mean, this formula for success, what seems simple, other cities are getting it wrong completely backwards, right? Their taxes are high, it's not safe, and they're not leaning into, they're rejecting innovation.
Are there downsides to growing this fast? Like, are there things that have to keep up that are harder to change? Like building code, housing density, those sort of cost of living things, like have you guys been able to drive reform there, or is that not where you want it to be?
So Ken Griffin recently was interviewed in a fireside chat like this and said, I'd rather have the problems of success than the problems of failure. And so there's no doubt that there are problems that stem from success, right? And housing prices, we had a tremendous amount of inflation in the last administration, and you sort of couple that with hyper demand here in Miami, and you get hyperinflation, right?
Right.
Housing costs have certainly gone up significantly, and we do everything we can to leverage public dollars and public assets like land to try to build projects at a 15-to-1 or 20-to-1 leverage rate. So for $100 million invested, we'll get $2 billion worth of projects. There's a 5 million housing shortage across the country, and Miami has its fair share, just like any other major city. Traffic, I know none of you guys have experienced any bad traffic this last 2 days, right?
I was in the car two hours and 40 minutes going over to that.
I'm not gonna tell you how far along we are with the boring company on trying to find underground boring systems or with some of the eVTOL companies that we're working with. But I do think that transportation generally has to sort of turn the page from, last generation's archaic solutions to
how
the next generation.
How did you get that train? What do you call it? The Sunshine Line or something?
Bright Line,
yeah. The Bright Line, yeah. How did you get that done so quick? And everybody says it's the greatest thing ever.
That's a private sector project that was done by a company. We had a piece of it, which was we did a piece with Tri-Rail to bring it into the station. And when we did that piece, we made it free for inner city residents to be able to use. So it was something that I was very proud of, was part of my legacy.
So a private company built it.
Correct.
You gave them the right of way?
No, they had the right. They bought the right of way. So it was totally private. So look, we have micro mobility options that are private, like scooters and
things. So all you did was just not get in the way.
Exactly. Shocking, by the way.
Shocking. Wow, what an idea.
Let me ask you. How
it's like the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm.
Do no harm.
Yeah.
How can mayors address, they come into office with a reform motivation and they're elected on, hey, we've got to fit, we don't have what Miami has. We got to fix this. We got to get the city working again. We got to attract business. We got to attract growth. And they inherit this regulatory morass, this massive infrastructure. Like San Francisco recently, I got all caught up in the fact that you can't put these phone booths in your office. You know, a lot of startups, I don't know if any of you guys have these phone booths, you gotta have someone go in and make a call, you put the phone booth in. And all my startups, all the companies I've been involved
in. Wait, you can't put one in San Francisco?
So you put these phone booths in and then you can go in and make calls. So when everyone's in an open desk configuration, but you gotta do a private call, you hop them in. So everyone loads up their offices with these phone booths. In San Francisco, they're illegal. Turns out that you need to run, and there's a piece of paper, which I was actually gonna tweet because it's insane. It's like 3 pages long. All the things you need to know about the phone booths that you want to put in your office. You got to get an architect review, an engineering review, a design review. You got to get sign off from the engineer. You got to submit the permitting fees. It gets reviewed by the city inspector's office. You got to design fire sprinklers that have to go into the phone booth.
It's nuts.
In case there's a fire in the phone booth, someone needs to put out the fire.
That's hilarious.
So I was talking to some folks about like, what are you going to do about this? But the mayor's kind of like, I don't know if there's enough action that I can take because it's in law that there's all this kind of regulatory stuff. How do you advise mayors that are stuck with this sort of an environment? And this is not just San Francisco. There's a lot of big cities in this country that have books and books of this stuff. And we can talk about philosophically why this has happened, sociologically why this has happened. Books and books of this stuff where the city can't get out of the way.
Yeah.
What do the mayors do? And when you guys get together, like, is there any advice or are we stuck? Like, What's the solution?
Well, we're not stuck. I think it's cultural, right? At some level, you have to inculcate a culture where you empower your employees to innovate and to deconflict. I think when people come to me with a problem, I say, look, first issue is if there's something that's blocking it that doesn't make any sense, why don't we just change it? We're legislators. That's what we do. We legislate so we can fix it. Maybe it happened, maybe it made sense 20 years ago, maybe it made sense 50 years ago. It doesn't make sense today, let's just change it. I think regulation is the other side of the coin from innovation, right? So regulation is telling you what you can't do or how to do something. Innovation is—
to protect loss.
It's sort of a first principles thinking. We wanna do this, right? We wanna make this work. And I think I regularly fall on the side of innovation. And I think you as a public official, frankly, who's elected by the people, really are the one that has to push the bureaucrats, the bureaucrat class, right? The bureaucrat class, they get very accustomed to saying no, they're risk averse, they're not incentivized oftentimes, right? There's no incentive structure that says, hey, if you innovate, you're gonna get X or Y or Z.
Yeah.
And then I think the third piece of it is artificial intelligence. I really feel that there's a breakthrough that's gonna come, and it's not just in transportation, we're talking about EV tolls and underground boring and all that, but I think in zoning codes and all that, it's gonna be computer to computer, right? So the codes are all straightforward, right? We have the same code for 15 years, right? Probably 97 or 8% of all known decisions have already been made under this code, right? So all you have to do is be replicated going forward, right? Unless the code changes, and then you just change the coding and you make the decisions all over again. So it's not that complicated. You should be able to submit something. The computer should be able to spit it out immediately. If it needs changes, it should tell you what the changes are. A computer could look at that, make the changes and spit it back in. Right, and if you were to do that, you know, it takes to get a permit on a home in most places in America, or on a building in most places in America, you know, 6 months, 9 months, a year and a half. I mean, it's insane. It should be done instantly. I mean, it could literally be done instantly with the technology that we already have available to us today. $100 billion business, by the way, in case anybody's wants to.
It's a great idea.
it's a
killer idea. I think some startups have worked on it too.
Multiple that are working.
Yeah, they work on the other side of it. Building on Freeberg's point, the two best proposals I heard about regulations, and I'm curious if you could steel mill them, or just how practical you think they are, putting a time limit on regulations. So if you fought for some regulations around these phone booths, back when phone booths, right. Superman changed his costume in them from the 60s and 70s, like back from that era, maybe it lasts for 20 years and then it expires. Or you want to add to regulations to office space regulations, you got to take one off the books. You know, and those were the two proposals I've heard. Some way of timing these out, or if you want to add, you got to find something to take off. Are either of those practical?
I kind of like the first one better than the second one, because the second one, this sort of one for one, there's got to be a reason to do one or the other, right?
Okay.
I like the first one better. Actually, what we normally do in government is the opposite. What we do is we do what we call pilots, right? So you'll do something that goes away very quickly, right? In other words, you implement a piece of legislation and say, oh, we're going to do it for a year. Let's test it out, right? And it's a pilot. And then it goes away. I like what you're saying in terms of, a big part of regulatory culture can probably be phased out over a 15, 20 year period as being anachronistic, right? It just doesn't work anymore.
5% a year get reviewed, and the government's responsible for reviewing 5% a year for 20 years, and they recertify it or 100%. Let it go?
Right, and then you have the ability to re-implement it if you think it makes sense, but I think what happens is you go back down to zero. You were asking, and Tony, and I was listening to the conversation, because we did it, like I said, we had to cut our budget by 20% in 1 year. And part of the problem is budgeting is like layering, right? It all layers on top of each other. Same as regulation, it layers on top of each other. So if you were to be able to strip it down in a mechanical way, right, in an instantaneous way, as opposed to having to fight the structures. In our case, we were very lucky. There was a state statutory vehicle that allowed us to implement the cuts. Otherwise, we'd have to bargain for them in a union process. Yeah. And obviously no one would ever bargain to cut their salaries. They would never bargain to cut
their- Nothing would have happened.
Nothing would have happened. We would have been bankrupt. And then a court would have taken us over. We would have looked like a joke. And instead we cut costs and we survived and we thrived, right, going forward. And by the way, my employees now love me. They were not happy the first couple of years when we did it. But now I don't even have to go to a union interview when I run for office. They just support me right away.
You want to be governor?
I don't think it's quite that simple.
I want to dunk.
Yeah. I want to be able to dunk too. Look, I think that I'm a Republican, for those of you who don't know. And, the president's already weighed in the Republican primary. I respect the president's perspective. I have a good relationship with Congressman Donalds. So I think politics is very circumstantial. We've talked about that a lot in the past.
Yeah.
So, things sometimes conspire in your favor. Sometimes things don't, right? And I do think it is circumstantial. So I think you have to weigh the circumstances. I ran for president because I had a thesis. The thesis was urban voters, Hispanics, and young voters, if they went Republican, would favor the Republican candidate, or the Republican candidate would win. And they did. It just wasn't me, right? It was a different candidate. But, the president did a great job on podcasts, right? Going on all these podcasts that, the vice president didn't do. And he got young voters and he got urban voters. Look, the Republicans never going to win Philadelphia, right? Trump lost Philadelphia to Biden by 85%, but he lost Philadelphia to Kamala by 75%. And that delta, the 75, 85, that 10% delta gave him Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's the election.
Which was such a crucial state, right?
Yeah.
Like arguably the winning state. So, Republicans are never going to necessarily win urban votes or the urban population centers throughout America. But you're also seeing, and I think it's important to note, you're seeing Democratic mayors lose across America. London Breed lost in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Tashara Jones lost in St. Louis. The mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, lost.
On that point, you were the head.
No, I was. I was a president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors for a year and a half.
Okay, if we had to ask you, you can't live in Miami.
Yeah.
You met all those mayors. Where are two places that you think are actually well-run, that aspire to do something great and have their shit together?
Cities?
Take your time.
Don't jump to an answer. I'll say this. I'll tell you a mayor that I like. How about that?
Okay.
Justin Bibb. Justin Bibb is mayor of Cleveland. We got a couple of Cleveland people here?
Apparently.
There we go. Justin is a good friend. I have a lot of friends that are mayors. I'm a mayor, I love all my mayors because I was a president of that institution. But I think Justin is a young, dynamic guy who's smart, not super partisan, cares tremendously about his city. And we talk a lot about it because obviously Miami and Cleveland are a little different, right?
On the margins, yeah.
That's fair. And we joke about it. He says, you know, I wish I had the kind of problems you have. To go back to sort of the Ken Griffin quote, you know, they don't struggle with affordable housing. They got plenty of affordable housing because people don't necessarily want to live there. Sorry, Jay, I love you, bro. But it's true, right? It's kind of true. So he's dealing with economic development. He wants to be the Miami of Ohio in terms of getting investment, getting the tech community there, getting people, special people to move into his community and believe in his vision. And I think, look, company building is hard. As you guys know, you guys have built some incredible companies. Ecosystem building is even harder, right? Yeah. It's 1,000x harder than building a big company.
I mean, companies take years into decades, and ecosystems take decades into centuries. Yeah.
Fair.
It's two different. Yeah.
Is there something that inside of the next gubernatorial campaign, let's say you don't run for governor,
yeah,
that's a high impact job at the state level?
Not really. I get to practice, and I have a private sector life. I have an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old. So, I mean, if the president called me and said, you know, I want you to be the U.S. ambassador to, you know, a country that I have a passion to help, you know, in terms of the United States, in terms of their relationship and world peace and things of that nature, which I think are high ROIs for the time investment and the financial sacrifice that you have to make, I would strongly consider it. But other than that, I mean, I live a very blessed life. You know, I'm the mayor of the best city on the planet, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And I have incredible, incredible, incredible bosses. These are my bosses. I have the best bosses in the world.
Yeah.
And they're constantly encouraging me. They're constantly cheering me on. And I live and breathe for them. I wake up early in the morning. I go to bed late. And I carry their problems, their hopes, and their dreams in my soul.
All right. Give it up for Francis Suarez, your mayor.
Thank you to our friend Francis Suarez, the mayor of Miami, for joining us on stage at our F1 event. And thanks to you, the audience, for tuning in. Give us a like, a thumbs up, a subscribe, write a review, whatever you're into, maybe send it to a friend. If you want to come to our next event, it's the All In Summit in Los Angeles, fourth year for All In Summit. Go to allin.com/events to apply. A very special thanks to our new partner, OKX, the new money app. OKX was the sponsor of the McLaren F1 team, which won the race in Miami. Thanks to Hyder and his team, an amazing partner and an amazing team. We really enjoyed spending time with you. And OKX launched their new crypto exchange here in the US. If you love All In, go check them out. And a special thanks to our friends at Circle. They're the team behind USDC. Yes, your favorite stablecoin in the world. USDC is a fully backed digital dollar, redeemable one for one for USD. It's built for speed, safety, and scale. They just announced the Circle Payments Network. This is enterprise-grade infrastructure that bridges the gap between the digital economy and outdated financial rails. Go check out USDC for all your stablecoin needs. And special thanks to my friends, including Shane over at Polymarket, Google Cloud, Solana, and BVNK. We couldn't have done it without y'all. Thank you so much.
It to the fans, and they've just gone crazy with it.
Love you, West. I'm the queen of quinoa.
I'm going all in.
Besties are gone.
Go 13. That is my dog taking a notice in your driveway.
Oh, man.
My
haberdasher
will meet me at Blitz. We should all just get a room and just have one big, huge orgy, because they're all just useless. It's like this like sexual tension that they just need to release somehow.
Your feet.
Wet.
Your feet.
We need to get merch.
I'm going all in.